Well, good morning. This is Pastor Caleb, and I want to say this, that I really do miss all of you, and I miss being with you and fellowshipping with you. However, because of this coronavirus and how it could be very dangerous and lethal to some, we as elders have decided not to meet traditionally, but try to figure out ways to minister to each other, encourage one another, and so one of the ways is through video sermons. And so I wish that we were all together. However, there's this thing that's beyond our control, this corona pandemic. There's also another thing that's going on in our culture, which is interesting. It's this idea that people are acting irrational. All around us, people are acting irrationally. And the question is, how should we as believers react when things are happening beyond our control, when the other person's acting irrationally, or when there's this pandemic that we don't have the cure, we don't have a solution. There is just this thing that's happening that's beyond our control. And so this morning, I wanted to point you to a particular text, Acts 27. And in Acts 27, I think we're going to find a lot of spiritual truths, a lot of spiritual help on how to deal with situations that are beyond our control, right? And in this particular section of Acts 27 that we're going to be looking at, there's going to be this major theme that's going to come up of this. Here's this man, the Apostle Paul, who's stuck in this situation. He's stuck in a situation that's beyond his control. And in one sense, we could look at it and say the Apostle Paul doesn't even belong in this situation. He was somehow thrust. The Apostle Paul could even ask the question, what am I doing here? Why am I here? Why me? What am I doing here? And so we're going to answer this question. How should we as believers handle things that are beyond our control? And this morning, we're going to try to answer the question, why am I here? Why is this happening? And we're going to deal with how we as believers should handle things beyond our control. So go with me to Acts 27, verse 1. Notice what it says. It says, when we decided that we would sail from Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. Now, it's important to remember that in the context, the Apostle Paul was in Caesarea. He was going through various trials. They didn't know what to do with the Apostle Paul. He hadn't done anything against Roman law. He really hadn't broken Jewish law. But the Jews really wanted him dead. The Romans really wanted to please the Jews, but they had nothing to charge him with. And the Apostle Paul had to go and speak the gospel to the emperor. He had to go to Rome. And so he appealed to Caesar. And in appealing to Caesar, he then was sent to Rome from Caesarea. So here is this innocent man acting like a prisoner with the rest of the prisoners. Now, it's important to realize that this journey from Caesarea to Italy would take about 5 weeks. And it's important to know that there's other prisoners along with the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul was a religious prisoner. He had a religious case, and he really wasn't breaking any parts of the law. He was essentially innocent. But then you have these other prisoners who were going to be sent most likely to the gladiatorial games. These were very dangerous men, very, very dangerous men. And so notice what happens here as we get into verse 2. Notice what happens. It says, and embarking in an Adramyttean ship, which was about to set sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to the sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. Now notice here, as he says us and he says we, it's most likely that Luke is along with Paul on this trip, and this is why Luke knows so many details. It's also important to remember that this particular ship, which is coming from along the coast of the Mediterranean, was most likely a cargo ship. And so they didn't have prison transports. They had to, the government would put them on ships that were heading where they needed to go. So we also see Aristarchus here, and Aristarchus is a fellow believer. Now notice what it says next in verse 3. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated, so that's a centurion, with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. Kind of a unique thing. The Apostle Paul, since he was not a violent offender and he was a religious offender, he was given probably a little bit more leeway than the rest of the prisoners. I don't think he would allow a thief or a murderer to have this much leeway. But he treated Paul with some consideration and allowed Paul to go to the believers where they ministered to him. And then notice what it says next in verse 4. It says, from there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Right? So as they're sailing along this island of Cyprus, the island is to protect them from this particular wind, which is coming from the north and pushing the ship south. They don't want to go south. They wanted to go west and they wanted to go northwest. And so the wind was pushing them the opposite way of where they wanted to go. So they used the island as a windshield. And then notice what it says next. It says, and when they had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. Now, they're entering onto a new ship. This ship was coming from Africa and most likely was a grain ship. As we'll see later on, this is a very late season for them to go and bring food to Rome. These men are trying to make a lot of money. It's most likely that they've already made this trip from Alexandria to Rome and back, which would take a total of about 10 weeks. And they're trying another trip. They're chancing another trip because it's going to be very lucrative. And so they get put on the ship. Notice what it says next. It says, and when we had sailed slowly for a good many days, and with difficulty, we arrived at Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go further. We sailed under the shelter of Crete off of Salamene, and with difficulty sailed past it, and we came to a place called Far Havens, near the city of Lasia. Right, so once again, they are on the ship and they are using an island as a windshield. They get to a particular port, and as they get there to that particular port, they get to the city. Right? Now, notice what happens in verse 9. All this other stuff is just kind of sailing information and how they sailed and how they used islands to block the wind. But notice what it says in verse 9. When considerable time passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them. So notice that things are starting to get dangerous, right? The fast was already over. Most likely that this is near the time of October. It's already far too late. In fact, it was common knowledge that people avoided sailing from November 11th to about mid-March. You just didn't sail in the Mediterranean. It was too dangerous. And so it was already far, far into the season, and it was becoming quite dangerous. Quite dangerous. And notice here's Paul, and he began to admonish them. And notice what he says in verse 10. He said to them, men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and of the ship, but also of our lives. But the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul. So then notice what it says in verse 12. Because the harbor was not suitable for wintering, the majority reached a decision to put to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest and spend the winter there. Right? So they didn't want to stay where they were staying. They just wanted to take a short trip and maybe they can find a safer harbor to spend the winter there. The Apostle Paul warned against them getting in the boat at all, but they wanted to just move a little bit further. By the way, this was a very short trip. This was a very short trip. This would be like the equivalent of us going to Portland, right? From Astoria. We would consider this a relatively short trip. Verse 13. When a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began to sail along Crete close inshore. As they're going, they realize that there's this moderate wind, and these guys think, hey, this is good luck. This wind is going to push us faster to where we are going to go. This is a faster wind. This is going to get us there. And it says, but before long, there rushed down from the island a violent wind called the Northeastern. This was a pretty dangerous wind. This was bad. This was a bad wind. And notice what it says in verse 15. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. So they tried to fight it as long as they could, but they couldn't fight it. A strong wind pushing them the opposite way of where they want to go. And it's so strong and so dangerous, and they're left in such a powerless decision, in this powerless, out of control position. What do? They say, to save our lives, we're just going to let the wind take the boat. It's beyond their control, right? It's far, far beyond their control. And so the question is, why is the Apostle Paul even on the boat? Why is the Apostle Paul in this situation? We could even ask ourselves, why are we in a situation that's seemingly out of control? The answer, I think, is quite simple. The answer is because God is sovereign. God's sovereign over the life of the Apostle Paul. He's sovereign over the sea. He's sovereign over diseases. He's sovereign over the world. And so when we talk about God's sovereignty, that God is in control, what we mean by this is not only that God has the right to rule, but he has the power to rule, and no one has the right to contradict his rule. So he has the right and power to rule. And the Bible has a lot to say about his sovereignty, right? So for example, the Bible depicts God as the only absolute king of the universe who rules over all and does what he pleases. So for example, Psalm 22, verse 28 says, for the kingdom is the Lord's, and he rules over the nations. Psalm 115, verse 3. But our God is in the heavens, and he does whatever he pleases. Whatever he decides to do, he will do, because he's in heaven. And then later on in Psalm 135, verse 6, it says, whatever the Lord pleases, he does. In heaven and in earth, in the seas and in all the depths. God does whatever he wants. He does as he pleases. Not only that, but he also rules actively according to his will. So God decides what to do, and he does it according to his will, and he ordains things to come pass on earth. So he never plays dice with the universe, right? The universe is never in a state of limbo where God's just throwing dice. This is planned out. This is all part of his plan. So for example, Psalm 33:11 says, the counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his hearts from generation to generation. Isaiah 45, verse 7, the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity, I am the Lord who does all of these things. In fact, there's seemingly small events that happen in our life that we think are something that would be chance or lucky. But actually what we find is that even small events are still under the purview of God's sovereignty. So for example, Proverbs 16:33 says, the lot is cast in the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. He is over all things. He's over our lives and our plans. Right? Proverbs 19:21 says, many plans are in the heart, in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord will stand. Then later on in 20:24, man's steps are ordained by God. How then can a man understand his way? Great events and decisions by mighty kings and by leaderships and by the leadership and by the government, these are even part of God's sovereign plans. Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. In fact, in Isaiah 45, does it not talk about Cyrus, whom the Lord appointed? Even disabilities and sicknesses, These are things that come by the sovereign hand of God. Notice Exodus 4:11. The Lord said to him, "Who has made the man's mouth? Or who has made him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" There's even actions which the Lord has allowed. He's allowed these men to act in certain ways. And this is still, God allows them to act this way. It doesn't mean that he condones the action, but rather he allows the action. We see this in the scriptures, right? So for example, in Acts 2, 22 through 23, it says this, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man tested you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourself know. This man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men." Let's be honest, even good deeds are preordained by God, and that God is sovereign even over the good deeds that we will fulfill. So for example, we think of like Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, where it says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God has prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them." Even salvation, friends, is part of God's sovereign plans. You and I were sovereignly elected before the foundation of the world to become believers. This was not based upon what God looked down time and said, "How would Caleb Hilbert react to the gospel?" No, it was based off of his knowledge. It was based off of his will that he chose me, right? So we see then, even over life and death, God has the power over life and death. Deuteronomy 32, 39. "See now that I am he, and there is no God beside me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal, and there is no one who can deliver you from my hand." So even the deaths that are happening, these global deaths, these terrible things that are happening, these are still part of God's sovereignty. God is not taken by surprise by these deaths. He's not taken surprise by this disease and by this pandemic. He's not taken by surprise by the people who are doing bad things at the grocery store and not leaving enough toilet paper for the rest of us. All of these things are under the sovereignty of God. All of these things have been allowed by the sovereignty of God. The operation of all creation, this is all under God's control. Psalm 104, verse 5 through 10 says this, "He established the earth upon its foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever. You have covered it with the deep as with a garment, and the waters were standing above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of your thunder, they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valley sank down to the place which you have established for them. You set a boundary so that they would not pass over, so that they would not return to cover the earth. He sends forth springs in the valleys, and they flow between the mountains." He then goes on in 13, "He waters the mountains," right? Verse 14, "He causes the grass to grow for the cattle." Verse 19, "He has made the moon for its seasons and the sun to know its place." God is even in control of time. He's in control of the waves. And friends, he even has allowed the coronavirus to happen. He's allowed some of these things to happen. And so the question is, as a believer, as there's all these things that are going on beyond my control, I can't control coronas, the coronavirus. I can't control how somebody's going to react in the grocery store. I know that God's sovereign. I know that whatever's happening, God's in control. I might not fully understand what he's doing, and he's not obligated to tell me all of the minute details of my future. But he does allow me to come to him, and he does allow me to trust him, and he does allow me to wait on him. And that which should really be our response. Our response, when things are beyond our control, how should the believer respond? The believer should respond by waiting on the Lord. When I think of a passage that talks about waiting, I think of Psalm 37, verses 1 through 7. So go with me to Psalm 37. Notice what Psalm 37 says. Do not fret because of evildoers, and do not envious towards wrongdoers. So do not be envious towards wrongdoers, for they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. So think of this passage here in Psalm 37. Notice what he's asking us to do. He says, do not fret because of evildoers, and do not be envious towards wrongdoers, for they are going to wither like the grass. They're going to be done away with. So in verses 1 through 2, what's he asking us to do? He's asking us to change our perspective. So I'm not supposed to be envious. I'm not supposed to fret. I'm not supposed to be anxious because I know their end. I change my perspective. I don't delight in the circumstance. I delight in the Lord in spite of that. And then notice in verse 3, then I trust in the Lord and do good. So then notice, I'm supposed to trust in the Lord and his plan. I'm supposed to trust in him. I'm supposed to dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. What am I to do? I'm to trust him. I am to believe his promises. I'm to stand on his promises. And I'm going to say, these promises are true. What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to trust in the Lord. And I'm supposed to do good. I'm supposed to follow out his will. And I'm supposed to think of his promises. Right? So I change my perspective. Things look this way right now. I realize that everything will pass. I know that Jesus is coming back again, and when he does, he'll make all right, all wrongs right. What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to trust him right now and do good. I'm supposed to follow his will. I'm supposed to trust him and follow his will. Verse 4, notice what it says in verse 4. It says, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Notice that my delight is not to be in health. My delight is not to be in what I have. My delight is not to be in anything else other than the Lord. And thus, if I'm satisfied in the Lord, and he will give me the desires of my heart, then the desire of my heart is him. Right? He will give me himself. Then notice what it says next. It says, commit your ways to the Lord. Trust also in him, and he will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your judgment as the noonday. Friends, not only should there be this trusting in the Lord and delighting in the Lord, there should be this commitment to follow the will of the Lord. And then notice this next one. This next one. It is, rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. What I should do is I should trust in the Lord and be obedient. I should follow the commands that are found in the scriptures. What should our first response be? Our first response should be, I understand that God is sovereign, and I'm waiting on him to act. And while I'm waiting on him to act, that means that I'm being obedient. I'm finding my delight in the Lord, and I'm being obedient. I'm being obedient to the things that he's asking me to do. So that is a really good challenge for all of us as our life is upended by corona and by the panic of our culture around us. This is exactly what we should do.